this summer in. And today we're looking at Mark 7, verses 1 to 30. These verses we are reading today are, I think, are some of the most powerful verses in all of Mark, and maybe in all of the New Testament. I wouldn't have said that earlier coming into this. But they are, in many ways, revolutionary to the people in Jesus' day, both to the religious establishment and to the culture in general. And in a similar way, I believe they are just as revolutionary today, both to the church and to our modern culture in the world in which we live. They're talking about how we approach God. And in many ways, this is the key issue at the heart of the gospel. As Christians and as a church, it's really a foundation for our purpose. And what is our purpose? To bring people into a personal and growing relationship with Jesus. At the heart of the gospel. And without understanding what Jesus is talking about today, I think it's very hard for us to truly be people who are loving God and loving people. You know, that's our tagline. You see it in the back of the bulletin every week there. And how do we love people in a way that draws them to Jesus? Well, I believe what Jesus is saying today is at the heart of all of that. You know, as I think back on my life, and I've reflected back on this a few different times in different ways, I realized I struggled to understand the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. I went to church all my life. I went to Sunday school. I knew Bible stories. I memorized scripture programs growing up. I went to Christian camps in high school. I went to the Sunday morning service. We had youth group in the Sunday afternoon. I went to the Sunday evening service. I could explain anybody how to become a Christian. I loved God and pursued faith, and I pursued it earnestly. Yet, as I look back on my life, despite all the evidence you might say to the contrary, as I look back now, I realize I didn't really fully understand the heart of the gospel. You see, all those things I did were external activities. And underneath it all, there was a restlessness that those external activities could not satisfy. So I was always looking for something more. And at the time, I wouldn't have been able to verbalize this at that time. It's as I look back on it. Now, as I said before, I date the beginning of my real faith journey to my freshman year in college when I asked Jesus to be part of my life, and that was kind of my anchor. And I still vividly remember the sense of peace that came in that moment that I really had not experienced before that was so real. I knew the gospel was real. But that was only the beginning, because I still don't think I understood the heart of the gospel. You see, when I came to faith and from that day on, my life in many ways didn't change because all the external activities of my life stayed the same as I was doing before. I was still active in a church. I was living a moral life by society standards and was reasonably successful in what I did. When I entered ministry, after working in many different fields, and I knew God had called me. And if you stay in New England as a new pastor, generally meant you were hired by some small, sometimes a medium-sized church that were struggling to grow in our culture and struggling to stay relevant to life. Some churches understood that, some didn't. And 3 or 4 years into pastoring, as I said before, I began to realize that all my years growing up in the church and everything I learned in seminary hadn't prepared for me for the pastoring in a number of ways. One is in terms of what it means to be a pastor and how to lead a church. But the other was in a sense of really understanding the heart of the gospel that keeps you firmly rooted in the midst of all of this. And at the same time, I was hitting my early 40s. And being in a small, struggling church that was constantly fighting, that was the church in my first 10 years, and looking around, seeing many of my friends from college who were established in careers, being more successful, I really struggled with the notion that, is my life going to be a failure? And so again, there was this underlying restlessness growing into me that was challenging my understanding of what the gospel is all about and how Jesus called us to live. But again, I would say all those circumstances around me were generated by external activities. And that's not what the gospel is all about. The heart of the gospel is something very different to how we tend to approach life as people. And that's what Jesus is focusing on today in Mark chapter 7. Listen to these words in Mark 7. I'm going to read the first 8 verses. You can follow on the screen or page 42 of the New Testament. And if you're going to the Pew Bible, I encourage you to keep your finger in that slot because we'll keep coming back to it. Listen to these words, Mark 7, verse 1. Now when the Pharisees and some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus, they noticed that some of his disciples were eating with defiled hands, that is, without washing them. Now in parentheses, you'll see in Mark parentheses often, what he's doing is he's explaining Jewish customs to primarily a Roman Gentile audience who would not know the Jewish traditions. So in verse 3 he says, for the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they thoroughly wash their hands, thus observing the traditions of the elders. And they do not eat anything from the market unless they wash it. And there are also many other traditions that they observe, the washing of cups, pots, and bronze kettles. So the Pharisees and the scribes asked Jesus, why do your disciples not live according to the traditions of the elders, but eat with defiled hands? He said to them, Isaiah prophesied rightly about you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines. You abandon the commandment of God and hold to human tradition. Now, all through Mark, we've seen how Jesus is in conflict with Jewish religious establishment. And in this text, some of the representatives from Jerusalem travel north to Galilee to really seek out the truth about Jesus and what he was doing and teaching. And they were really looking for reasons to trap Jesus and to build a case against him so they could get rid of him. So they see Jesus' disciples eating without washing their hands. Now, I don't know about you, but we might say, what's the big deal about that? Now, of course, if you're a mom, you know, and have kids, you always say to your kids before dinner, have you washed your hands? Because kids never do it. But that's an issue about hygiene. But here the leaders, religious leaders, were concerned that the disciples weren't following the religious traditions, the traditions of the elders. Now, back in the book of Exodus, chapter 30, we're not going there. The law given by Moses simply declared that priests who entered the sanctuary had to wash their hands and feet before they could offer sacrifices on the altar. Now, the reason behind that is the notion that God is holy and pure and tolerates no evil in his presence. So the washing of the hands and the feet symbolically represented that they were spiritually clean and morally pure and could enter into God's presence and perform and offer the sacrifices. Well, over the years, the Jewish religious leaders extended that thought and built up a whole series of traditions about what would make you unclean and require you to wash your hands or feet. You were considered unclean and ritually impure if you touched a dead animal or a human being, or if you had a skin disease, or if you came in contact with mildew anywhere, if you had a bodily discharge or ate meat that was considered unclean. So all of these efforts to wash and stay clean from dirt and disease were supposed to be a reminder, a visible symbol to them that they were spiritually and morally unclean and couldn't enter the tabernacle to worship God unless they had purified themselves by the simple act of washing. Now, that seems very strange to us today, and I'll explain why in a few minutes. But in some ways, we're really not that much different. If you go on a date, or go to a job interview, or go to meet someone important, what do? I know what I did this morning, come to church. You saw me yesterday working and repairing our bathroom. I was a mess. But I knew this morning, what do? You wash, you brush your teeth, you comb your hair, you put on the appropriate clothes, you use deodorant and aftershave or perfume because you want to present well, look good, and smell good. Well, that was the same idea behind the traditions around cleanliness. You wanted to be spiritually clean when you came to worship a holy and perfect God. So these traditions had become an important part of life for the religious Jews during Jesus' day. And surely if Jesus was a good Jew, the religious leaders thought that he would teach his disciples to observe these traditions. And clearly his disciples were not following the rules. Big problem. When one talks about this text, often we just tend to focus on religious traditions and how they can become rigid and problematic. Now, there's nothing wrong with traditions. Every church develops its own traditions that give meaning to their faith. They represent a spiritual truth. It doesn't matter whether the church is, and I hate these categories, but it doesn't matter whether the church is liturgical, traditional, contemporary, whatever label you want to give to it. Every church has its rituals and traditions. And we just want to have to keep them relevant and connected to what's the spiritual reality behind them so they don't become an end in themselves. And the problem becomes when the symbols and the religious practices become an end in themselves. They become a required spiritual exercise. And the rite itself becomes more important than the spiritual experience behind it. That's what we call traditionalism. And that tends to be deadly. Because now you judge a person's faith based on whether or not they observe the right rituals. And you're not concerned with, do they understand what's the experience behind them? You know, for example, I grew up in the church, and you know, I was born in the 50s and grew up in a very kind of traditional church setting. And there, you were considered a good Christian if you dressed nicely and went to Sunday morning service. You went to Sunday evening service, and you're a really good Christian if you went to a Wednesday night prayer meeting. You know, and then you were involved in some committee or some organization, and maybe you taught Sunday school. And then also along with that, there were these things that you did. You didn't smoke, you didn't swear, you didn't dance, you didn't go to movies, you didn't get divorced, you didn't do any of those things. Then you're a really good Christian if you didn't do those things. You know, there's even an updated standard that you find in gospel preaching churches today. Sometimes it'll say, if you're a good Christian, you'll attend the main worship service. You'll tithe your income. You'll read the Bible daily. You'll be a part of a small group Bible study, and you'll serve in some ministry regularly. Now, there is nothing wrong with any of those things. In fact, all of those things are good things and in many ways should be part of our life. But if you judge a person's life by those external actions, then they become more important than the spiritual experience that's supposed to be behind them and that they represent. And what does that do? That removes grace from the gospel. It brings judgment as you look on people and judge them by whether or not they do these things or not. It turns away the unchurched and non-religious. It burns out Christians at times because they don't find the satisfaction. It leaves people unsatisfied. It also leads to a worse kind of hypocrisy. Because we judge people by whether they do what we do or not do. And that's what the Pharisees were doing in Jesus' day. When we hear Pharisee today, we equate it with the word hypocrite. Church struggles all through the ages. The church struggles today with the same thing. But there's a much deeper meaning to this text than just a conversation about religious traditions and traditionalism. There's something much deeper that goes to the heart of the gospel. And again, I have to say I'm very thankful to Tim Keller, pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church, because he really pointed this out in a way that most other commentators did not. All of the religious practices that I just mentioned and we are talking about are external actions. And what we do becomes more important than who we are and what's in our heart. That is a pattern of life that is living from the outside in. Everything will be good in life if the exterior behaviors, actions, and words are all good. How many of you remember the movie that was released in 1995 and 2004 called The Stepford Wives? Anybody seen that? Women, you must have hated this movie. The men, I even hate the movie. The men in this wealthy suburban community get together and they create these perfect robotic images of their wives. And all their external actions of these women are perfect. They dress beautifully. When they go to exercise class, they're dressed beautifully. They speak softly and they always look good and they never nag or complain. In the movie, you can actually go and see the women on the golf course caddying for the husbands when they're playing golf. Ugh. I mean, it's just... but you know... It's just a perfect explanation of our text today. Look at, notice behind her, all the egg crates are just perfectly in place. is Nicole Kidman, and she fought this all the way through the movie. So the closing scene in the 2004 movie is her having been robotized, I guess, roboticized, or whatever you want to call it. But the movie just mocks this notion that life will be perfect if all the external actions are right. I mean, it is. The movie is pretty nauseating, but it's go look at it sometime if you haven't seen it. But it's right on target what we're talking about in Mark 7. And in these verses, Jesus kind of blows it all up. Listen to these words again in verses 6 to 8. Jesus said to them, Isaiah prophesied rightly about you. You are hypocrites, as it is written. This people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines. You abandon the commandments of God and hold to human tradition. Jesus is simply saying, you're just concerned about what you say and what you do, all external actions. But the reality is that your heart, your attitudes, your thoughts are all far from me. Now in verses 9 to 13, he goes on to give us another example besides the cleanliness laws of where their religious traditions ignore the spiritual reality behind that. You're going to have to read that yourself. I'm not going to go to that today. But then he goes on and he says to the crowds in verses 14 and 15, he says this, then Jesus called the crowd again and said to them, listen to me, all of you, understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile. Jesus is saying our external words and actions are not the real problem. It's what's in our hearts that make us spiritually unclean before God. You see, religion and the world, how it looks at life, operates life from this premise. You live from the outside in. But the gospel is different. It reverses everything and it operates from the, you live from the inside out. That's the core of the gospel. When we look at the outside in, God looks at the inside out. Remember what Jesus began preaching in Mark 1:15? The time is fulfilled. The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel. Jesus is saying God is doing something new. Now, it's not different than the Old Testament. It completes it and fulfills it. But he's calling out something that at the heart in a way that hasn't been explained before. Now, let's flesh out that concept here. What Jesus is saying is that in our natural state, we are unfit to live in a relationship to God, to come into His presence. We are all selfish, morally stained, and break God's commandments. And we offend God, who is pure, holy, and without blemish. And in today's world, and even in many churches today, they have a major problem with that concept. I didn't understand it fully. Because, you see, I live by all the right religious actions and moral standards of society. So when you look at the world, you think of yourself as pretty okay and not as spiritually unclean. And the problem with that is we don't fully appreciate the extravagant love and grace of God. The amazing thing here is that Jesus was agreeing with the Pharisees. He was saying we are all spiritually unclean before God. We're all sinners. There's that dreaded word we hate using today, the world does not like. He was just disagreeing with them as to the source of that uncleanness. It doesn't come from our words and actions. It comes from our heart. Think back how the Greek and Roman gods and the gods of many pagan religions were portrayed. The gods were always seen as angry and judgmental, and human beings were always offending the gods and had to figure out how to appease them and keep the gods happy. Think about the Christian faith, how it was portrayed in the Middle Ages, and really right up through the 19th century, much of the church's preaching was all about sin, judgment, and hell. Religion loaded us down with guilt and shame. Jesus never denied hell, judgment, sin. But he is teaching us here, we're morally unclean, but he did not appeal to people with guilt and fear. Because no one wants to live that way. So what's happened in our world today? In our modern world, we have begun to reject the notion of moral absolutes. We don't like this notion of a God who talks about judgment and hell and sin, because we don't want to feel guilt and shame. And we say basically people are good, but sometimes they make bad decisions and they're influenced by the environment around them. And it is the social structures around them, poverty, family dysfunction, inequality, that cause them to do bad things. Now, there is an element of truth to that. I'm not going to deny that. But the assumption is if they lived in the right environment, they would be okay. And if there is a God, then he has to be a God who's just going to accept us as we are and not make unreasonable demands on us. Our world and many churches abandon the notion of sin and a holy God. But even abandoning that, people still struggle with finding meaning and purpose. We still often struggle with feelings of guilt and shame. We often still don't feel loved and accepted. We often still feel insignificant. This approach doesn't solve our basic problem as people. Dorothy Sayers is an English poet and author, a Christian who lived during and after World War II. And Tim Keller, in his book Jesus the King, referenced Sayers. And she said that World War II was a real blow to the educated class of England, who had an optimistic belief in the civilizing influence and enlightenment of civilization and man. She goes on to say in another work that for centuries, politics and modern culture operate on the basis that there is nothing wrong with the human heart. We are all basically good. What's wrong with the world is in its social structures, the lack of education, the lack of equal opportunity. And if we just fix all these things, then human society would achieve greatness and move beyond the evil we see in the world. But World War II, the constant warfare since, the greed, the corruption, the massive evil we see, should disavow us of any such belief. It doesn't match up with reality. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great Russian thinker, said this: "The line between good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, how appropriate for today, but right through every human heart, through all human hearts." Life won't truly work living from the outside in. It doesn't bring true substance, it won't satisfy God, and it doesn't change the fundamental human problem. We're all sinners. So Jesus goes on to talk about the food laws. Now, rules for kosher food found in the Old Testament. And he says this, beginning in verse 17. "When he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about the parable. He said to them, 'Then do you also fail to understand? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile, since it enters not the heart, but the stomach, and goes into the sewer?' Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, 'It is what comes out of a person that defiles, for it is from within, from the human heart, that evil intentions come: fornication, theft, murder, adultery, avarice, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, envy, slander, pride, and folly. All these evil things come from within. They defile a person.'" Now, this is radical teaching for the disciples to really understand. Jesus talks about the food laws because in the human body, in a sense, there's not a connection between the stomach and the heart. You see, in the stomach, it's all about external things we put in, that it all still all ends up in the toilet, in the sewer. But it's what comes out of our heart, our attitudes, our feelings, our thoughts, our desires that truly destroy and corrupt our lives and bring evil into the world. And we all deal with that. So Jesus does this radical thing. He declares all foods clean. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm glad he did that. Because as New Englanders, we should be glad, because now we can eat shellfish, lobsters, and shrimp. And pork is my favorite, so now I can eat pork. But, you know, in Matthew, it says that Jesus didn't come to do away with the law, but to fulfill it. And what he's saying here is that we don't have to worry about the food laws anymore or some of the ceremonial religious laws in the Old Testament, because they're about external actions. And that's never going to earn you God's approval or grace. He's saying, "I came to change that, to fix the heart." Now, the disciples struggle with this. Jesus is amazed and he asks them, "Don't you understand? Don't you get it?" The early church struggled with this because the major debate all through Acts was, don't Gentiles, non-Jews, who become Christians, have to become Jews, and don't they have to obey the Old Testament laws too? You know, that was always there. The church continues struggles with this today. I did a lot for a lot of my adult life. We look at our lives, the good religious things we do, and we look at the evil in the world, and we think we're okay, basically good, and we miss the point of the gospel. Those are all external actions, and we fail to understand that all our hearts are selfish and morally unclean before God. We are no better or no worse than anyone else in the world. And then Mark goes on, and he gives us this very classic example, beginning in verse 24, about this interaction he has with this Gentile woman. And it says, "From there he set out and went away to the region of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know he was there. Yet he could not escape notice. But a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately heard about him. And she came and bowed down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile of Syrophoenician origin. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. Jesus said to her, 'Let the children be fed first, for it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs.' But she answered him, 'Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumb.' Then he said to her, 'For saying that, you may go. The demon has left your daughter.' She went home and found the child lying on the bed and the demon gone." Now, Jesus was tired of the conflict with the religious leaders, tired of trying to help the crowds and the disciples understand he was teaching. So he goes to a Gentile city, figuring he could get away. And then what happens here is really radical. You see, the Jews in Jesus' day referred to Gentiles, non-Jews, as dogs. It was the ultimate example of extreme racial prejudice and cultural prejudice. In our culture, we value dogs and consider them to be valued members of our household. You know, we treat them sometimes better than we treat people. But in their culture, in Jesus' day, dogs were considered dirty and unclean. So the term, as applied to the Gentiles, is the ultimate racial put down. And in this city, Jesus encounters a Gentile woman. Now, women had no rights in those days. Jewish rabbis, teachers, would never have a one-on-one conversation with a woman. But here's Jesus talking with a Gentile woman. He's crossing all the barriers. She's the most unlikely person to understand what Jesus is teaching about the gospel. But she's the only one that truly gets it. So Jesus says to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." Jesus is not putting her down here. He's testing her. If Jesus was truly being a bigot, he never would have talked to her in the first place. Jesus is saying to her, "Look, I came to bring the gospel first to the Jews because they're the children of God." But there's hope for her in that sentence to the Gentiles. Why? Because the implication is later he's going to bring the message to the Gentiles. And that's what he does. Before he ascends into heaven, he says to his disciples to go into the entire world and preach the gospel to everyone, everywhere. The woman understands implicitly what Jesus is saying when she says, "Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." She's saying to Jesus, "I get it. I understand. I don't deserve anything from you. I can never earn or will never deserve your help. I'm morally unclean. I'm a bankrupt." There's humility in her answer. But there's also hope in her answer. How many of you or your children feed your dog under the table at mealtime? Discreet, put the food and throw it down the floor. She's saying, "That's just what we do. We feed our dogs some of the scraps from the plates. So I know that even if you came to the Jews first, I know that you have enough left over to meet my need, to heal my daughter and to change my life. And that's good enough for me." And because she understood that, Jesus healed her. She was simply saying to God, "Yes, I know I'm a sinner. I know that I'm morally bankrupt and spiritually unclean before you. You're holy and pure, and I can never deserve anything you do for me. I can never earn your approval by who I am, by my external actions, by what I do. But I also know that you love me and value me and want to heal me and change me. And I can accept that. She gets what Jesus is saying. She understands the heart of the gospel. The religious leaders don't get it. The crowds don't get it. The disciples don't get it. The early church struggled to understand it. And the same is true today. The world out there doesn't get it because they say people are basically good. They're not morally bankrupt before God. They hate the word sinner because it just brings guilt and shame, and that's bad. And too often in the church we don't get it because we bought the notion that people are basically good. And we look at ourselves and we see ourselves as pretty good moral people when compared to the world out there. And that's what I did. And as a result, we have one of three responses. We point fingers and harshly judge the world around us for the corruption and evil we see because they don't do the right things that we do. But we fail to see our own moral bankruptcy, and that breeds hypocrisy like the Pharisees of Jesus' day. Or we look at our friends and neighbors and co-workers around us and observe that they're pretty good moral people even if they're not religious. And we fail to see that they are spiritually and morally unclean before God, and they need the gospel. They need the cross. They need God's love and forgiveness. And in both cases, we're living by the outside in, not by the inside out. And third, we will fail to fully appreciate what God has done for us in the gospel. That Jesus freely died on the cross so that we might be totally forgiven and totally accepted and made clean by God. That we're valued and loved and accepted by the one person who really matters in this world. And if we don't see that, then as a result, we won't be passionately in love with God. I am not pointing fingers at anyone here because I struggled to understand this for a good portion of my adult life. Why is it that someone who is a drug addict or an alcoholic or is in jail and their life is falling apart and they come to faith in Jesus, they are so excited because they realize they didn't deserve anything God did for them. And they are excited to know they are loved and accepted and forgiven. And sometimes, having grown up in the church, I kind of looked at myself and said, well, I do all these good things. I live a moral life. And I don't understand that I'm just as morally bankrupt before God because He's pure and holy as anyone else in this world. We're all in this together. But if we don't get this, we'll never work to passionately pursue our church purpose, to bring people into a personal and growing relationship with Jesus. We won't be praying for people to come to faith, praying for one. We won't be looking for those opportunities for conversation. We won't be inviting people to things like Alpha or other opportunities where such conversation can take place about Jesus. And if that is the case, we'll never be passionate in our love for God and people in a way that impacts people. Because we'll be looking at the externals, not looking at the heart, realizing that all people, whoever they are, no matter how good they are, by human standards, still are morally unclean before God. The heart of the gospel. We are all morally and spiritually bankrupt before God, and we can never earn His approval by our external actions. That's living from the outside. That's living from, when we live by external actions, that's living from the outside in. And it never addresses the real problem, the heart. The truth and the reality is, you know, living from the inside out is not a sad thing. To say that we're a sinner morally bankrupt for God brings full of hope, because implicit in that truth is that God loves us and has done everything He needed for us through Jesus on the cross. And that we are loved and valued and accepted, and He changes us from the inside out. He changes our hearts. And there we find the greatest acceptance and security and value that can be found in this world. Do you really understand the heart of the gospel? Let's pray.